Hey everyone, there's a little bit of Kathy's song there with Simon and Garfunkel. We hear the rain falling softly against the window, and it's just a beautiful song to get us going on this rainy day here. We could just settle in and just enjoy it here as we continue our conversations here. So again, this is Jerry Fabian, KYGT, LPFM, 102.7, 103.9 on the air, and we're going to transition over here in the rabbit hole to Writer's Talk, and this next hour is going to be brought to you by me, Jerry yes, Fabianic. There you go. And you can go to jerryfabianic.com and find out more about the topic at hand here. I was on, did an interview here about my book back at the end of February, and Greg Markle was sat and we talked about it. And so I have that conversation, but 2 weeks ago, my good friend here, Stephen Craig, was in the studio, and we were talking about his book, Waiting for Today. And after we got off the air, we had a great conversation about it. And, you know, after we got off the air, and he says, okay, turnabout is for play. So, and so we're going to have a conversation here about Sisyphus Wins. And, you know, this time I am going to be responding to the questions.
Turnaround is fair play, my friend.
All right. I'm on the not-so-hot seat here. It's nice and cool in the studio.
It's actually a lovely place to be out of rainy afternoon.
Oh, it is. It's great. So, all right. Welcome,
so settle in,
thanks
folks.
For coming in.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me back, Jerry. It's a pleasure and an honor and a privilege, my friend.
Thank you.
So, should we get right at it?
Oh, let's get right at it.
Two former English teachers talking literature, and great literature at that. And I just
there's going to be a test on this when we're done too. So, when everybody out there listening, yeah,
no, your students really. Know that's probably somewhat true.
No,
no, but I just want to before we do get going, obviously, and Representative Becker mentioned this on her way out the door as well. For those of you who haven't read Sisyphus Wins yet, go ahead and plug it first before we even begin.
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay. Yeah. It's just a wonderful novel, and absolutely cannot recommend it more highly to folks
Thank
out
you.
There listening. But in any case, we came to the last time I was here, we had ourselves a nice little conversation after our interview, and we started talking a bit about your book, and I thought that was a wonderful place to begin. You know, when we first started talking about my novel, Waiting for Today, we started off with characters. I think that's always, as a literature teacher, I think that's a great mm-hmm. place to start. Mm-hmm. And you know, very much your protagonist, Jonathan, perhaps a little bit more autobiographical in nature than mine. Tell us a little bit about Jonathan, and tell us how much of Jonathan is autobiographical, how much is the creation of the imagination?
Oh, wow. You know, there. It's true. I put a lot of myself into Jonathan, but there's a lot in there. It's not. Is there a way of, you know, defining it in a precise way? No. I go back at my good friend Jason Steinle when he wrote a review for me for the book. And let me see. I have it here. And he says in there about it's hard to know where truth begins and or the fiction begins. Yeah, let me find it here. I'll go exactly there. Realtor dance back and forth. The reader, okay, the last sentence, the reader is ultimately left wondering where the line is between truth and fiction. You know, I think it's Stephen, one is, you know, my attachment to the character of specific events or, you know, building on that, but also as an ideal, you know, when you look at this and it's like, okay, who is this character? And what would I like Jonathan to be? So maybe that would be, who would I like Jerry to be?
Is it an idealized vision of self then? Is that where we're going? Because Jonathan mm-hmm. himself has flaws. He's hardly mm-hmm. the idealized vision. Mm-hmm. So where is that line between idealized self and real self?
Well, I think that's the ultimate goal of life is self-actualization. I think right. Abraham Maslow taught us that way back in
Absolutely.
The 50s. And as we keep working on stuff, you know, I point out to people, you know, taking the Buddha, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, we're not the Buddha. And, you know, you feel you could be enlightened, or you want to move to enlightenment. You want to be self-actualized. But you also have crappy days. And you have to have crappy days. Because if you don't have crappy days, you can't really enjoy the good ones, you know, and, or appreciate, not just enjoy, but appreciate, you know, serenity and happiness. And, you know, if we always had sunshine, 365 days of the year, you know, okay. But now, even having a, you know, a rainy day like this is a pleasant, you know,
it's going to make Monday make Monday all the more pleasant. But it's exactly that informative dichotomy we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Speaking of the more difficult experiences Jonathan goes through, tell me a little bit about how, in your vision as the author, how is the loss of his father in very early childhood and subsequently his mother later in life, how do you think that that impacts Jonathan as a character?
Initially, he's lost. With the loss of the father early in life, he's lost because, you know, and there's a scene I create when he's talking to his first grade teacher. And he says, you know, she asks him, and he says, well, he's dead. And, of course, little kids, they're 6 years old. Well, what does that mean? Well, he's dead. He's in the ground. He's no longer here. And he really didn't know him because he was too little to really remember him consciously. He probably remembers him subconsciously, unconsciously. But he just knows missing. And he looks around at his friends, and they all have dads. And his is gone. And so there is this loss, separation, and an insecurity, if you will. And so, therefore, he's searching for something, someone to fulfill that role. Now, it could be, you know, an older, another person in his life, another man who could serve, you know, in that role.
Sure.
Then again, it could be perhaps like the church that I build everything around, the institution right there with the priest and so forth there.
Right. I mean, you can fill that void. And matter of fact, as you get further on in the novel, as he goes into adulthood, one of the more striking passages, and just love to quote it from you on page 188, in a sort of self-narrative, he asked the question, "Would you have loved me, Dad? As I am for who I am." But he never answers the question, at least not at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
Would Jonathan's, as the author sitting back now, how do you think that question gets answered? For knowing as the author, as the creator of that character, what would Jonathan's father, how would he answer that question?
Without giving too much away in the spoiler alert, I think the answer is in the affirmative, that he does. And in the story, as it unfolds later with the interaction with his dead father, if you will, there's a reinforcement of sorts.
Right.
And so I think it is answered in the affirmative, you know, yes, I would have loved you regardless. Now, how would that have played out, though, in real life? Because Dad might not have been able to be more comfortable. Remember, this series is set back, you know, in the 60s and 70s.
Absolutely,
you
right.
You know, and, you know, we talk about gay sexuality today. You know, it's more bandied about. It's not, you know, as oppressive or anything like that, you know, for some. But nonetheless, it's far more, quote, out of the closet than it was then.
Absolutely. Well, his father, I mean, the father figure in the book, even though in his absence, he sort of takes on it and is representative of a entire culture that I think Jonathan feels that sort of questioning about. So how, in what ways do you think that Jonathan derives an answer to that, a comfortability with how his father would have answered that question for him? Because the fact of Ants asking for your father, who you've never really known, and asking for his approval, I found that a really poignant moment in the novel, as he's sitting there and he's asking the father he's never known for approval for his entire lifestyle, that as an audience, we accept Jonathan because we know him and embrace him. Mm-hmm. And yet here's a character whose sensibilities cause him to question his own self in a way by asking his own father. It's a questioning of self by asking a father that he never knew. Do you think that Jonathan comes to a settled point in that regard?
I think eventually he does. Now, the answer is never really, or the question, is it really ever, I shouldn't say it is, but is it really answered in the story itself? Because there's a couple ways. You know, a father does not necessarily have to understand everything about or necessarily approve of a particular aspect of one's character.
Right.
But if the love is universal and unrestricted or any way, it's boundless, that I will love you in spite of no matter what, because your presence and your health and your happiness is the most important thing, whether I can put my hands around this other stuff or not.
And isn't that, and we'll get to some of the religious aspects and themes of the novel as well, but isn't that a huge part of what makes Jonathan Jonathan? Is his search for unconditional love and support in a world that has very clearly told him that he's not.
Yeah.
That has questioned who he is, and as such, it leaves him going even to a father that he never knew for the unconditional love that he feels like he's never gotten.
Yes,
and I think it's gut wrenching as the audience to see the world through Jonathan's eyes. That the fact that love is based upon who you are and the decisions and choices that you make.
Mm-hmm. And keep in mind too that within this particular, the context of this particular religion, Catholicism, that the reverend, unlike in Protestantism, is addressed as father.
Right. Absolutely.
And so we draw right
it's
on
very
that.
Patriarchal.
Yeah, yes.
Very patriarchal, and I think the fact that it's the father that he's asking for.
And you know, and if you look at the, there are a couple priests, several priests in there, three of them.
Yeah, we'll be talking about at least one of them.
And, two in his earlier life, and then one that comes in, and they all play different roles in his life. And so when you have, it's kind of like the good cop, bad cop sort of thing here with the two priests in his earlier life, as he's going through his ordeal, that psychological, thing there, and the good side and the tough side of the father.
Right. So speaking of which, tell us a little bit about Father Reginald as a character.
Okay.
Skipped a little ahead on myself, but that's okay. I think it's more pertinent here. Tell us a little bit about Father Reginald and exactly that sort of patriarchal dynamic that you were exploring right there.
Yeah, he's searching for answers to his dilemma.
Right.
And for one reason or another, he's able to connect with this priest who comes into his life in his junior, senior year in high school. So they have a relationship there. And so he takes a chance. He trusts him.
Right.
And that's the key thing. And so he's able to have a relationship, an honest, open discussion with this priest, with this aspect of father.
Right.
Okay. And the Father Reginald gives back to him support, unconditional love, and that's the aspect is that unconditional love. It is supportive. It is caring. And so that's the positive he gets back from Father Reginald.
Right. In a world, in a very patriarchal world, we have a somewhat more feminine character in the sense of the unconditional love, the nurturing, and the support that he gets. Take a thought for a second about another patriarchal figure in the book, and in this case, Jonathan's brother, Theodore. How would you describe his brother, Theodore, and would you characterize Theodore as a foil character for Jonathan? If so, how might you think of that, conceive of that as a...
Explain foil for our listening audience, too. You and I get that as teachers, but
so,
go on.
So, a foil character is a character that bears some similarity to the protagonist, but differs in certain very distinct ways. And in those distinct ways in which they're different, casts a very informative light about about the choices that the protagonist makes. And in this way, I think that there are some very clear, beyond just the fact that they obviously grew up in the same household, had the same parents, Theodore and Jonathan bear some very important resemblances to each other, and yet Theodore chooses a very different road than Jonathan chooses to go down. And I think it's in that difference between the two of them that it is very telling about the choices that Jonathan makes and why those are such important choices.
And I don't really see Theodore, although there could be some elements where he could fulfill that role as foil. I see Theodore as having a very conflicted aspect of his being.
Right.
Both, they're brothers. They're both conflicted.
In what ways do you think Theodore is conflicted, and is that similar or different from how Jonathan's conflicted?
Whatever his conflict is, he's not willing to deal with it. That, I think that's the important thing, is that he is putting it away. He clouds it over. It's almost like a self-loathing,
right,
if you will, aspect to his character. Whereas Jonathan explores, and saying, okay, I'm conflicted too. It's like every other human being. We all have personal internal conflicts about ourselves. But rather than to demean himself or judge himself in a harsh, negative way, he has to, first of all, come to accept himself,
right,
and say that, no, I'm not bad, I'm not evil, I'm not corrupt or anything like that. And I don't know how this is going to play out in the larger arena stage of the world, but I need to figure this out, and I'm going to go out and search for answers. And right. I don't think Theodore does that.
And that's where I was getting to with the foil question.
Okay.
Is it both of them, to me, the point which you sort of defined it perfectly for where I was going, was that both of them have that inner conflict within themselves. And how they choose to address that conflict is, I think, very telling about why Jonathan is such a vital character, and why his story is so important for all of us. Mm-hmm. And that Theodore chooses to, as you said, Theodore chooses to repress that conflict within himself. And it turns into a self-loathing that even he seems to be, to some degree, unaware of. Mm-hmm. Whereas Jonathan, as difficult and as painful as taking on that conflict and really delving into it with full honesty and disclosure, mm-hmm, that's a difficult road, not to give away the entire novel, but it's a difficult road that Jonathan goes down in order to have that. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was going at with the idea of the foil, that to some degree or another, Theodore's refusal to do so, where do you think that leaves Theodore as a character by the end of it all? As compared to Jonathan, who, in the end, is there a lesson to be gained by the way that Jonathan reacts to that inner conflict as compared to how Theodore deals with that inner conflict?
I think the lesson to be learned, I would think, is that there's the positive and then there's the repressive. And if we repress our darker side, if you will, the psychological, what's in our subconscious, our unconscious there, mm-hmm, if we repress it and put it away and don't honor that, okay, it leads to all kinds of other psychological crises in, mm-hmm, our lives and debilitation. And so we don't become authentic, functional human beings that could be positive, interactive in the larger society and, mm-hmm, contribute to. Okay, because if we're always putting something away in our closet and keeping it there, that's going to interfere with our ability to, as I say, be a functional, full-fledged and a human being and reach that level of self-fulfillment that we were talking about earlier there with Abraham Maslow. Jonathan is not afraid. I mean, he's daunted by this here. But by the fact that he says, okay, I got to do this, and I'm not going to quit, and I might be on my own.
And it's going to be a long journey getting there, too.
It is.
A long, difficult journey.
And that's what I hope, that whole thing, it ties in with the title then, Sisyphus, pushing the rock up the hill. You keep doing it and doing it and doing it until you can,
And that's why this is such an important novel. It to me, and it was interesting I, when you created the contrast between repressed, the word that you used on the other side was, mm-hmm, positivism. Mm-hmm. And the idea that which is, you have two choices to go down. We all have our inner demons. All of us do. Mm-hmm. And we have a choice in this life to repress those inner demons, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or we have a choice to deal with them and come out on the other side of them healthy and constructive.
Right.
And I think that that's why, that's where I was going with that idea of Theodore, I think, is every bit, to some degree, as illuminating a character as Jonathan is
in
the novel.
Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about Christopher, another one of Jonathan's siblings. Tell me a little bit about Christopher. Where do you see his role in all this?
I love Christopher. Christopher is also an older brother. And I put him, it's interesting because the dynamics, the dualism that's in here, because in a way, then Christopher becomes sort of a foil for Theodore.
Okay. Explain that. That I'm intrigued by.
Theodore is, and there's symbolism in their names.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Theodore is man of God, theos, theology.
Right.
It's Greek. Okay. So, God. That's front and fore center right there. So he is personification of all of that. Christopher, ironically, has the his name is built on the Christ.
Right.
And yet he's completely agnostic, if not atheistic, and very much a humanist
right.
in his philosophy. And so as a boy, when Jonathan... He's eager to learn. You know, he prides himself that he's learned all the capitals of the states. You know, he goes to sleep at night and he looks at the encyclopedia. He just reads. You know, I can't get enough knowledge. I want to learn. He reads Moby Dick, for God's sake. I want to see, you know, I mean, he goes into that and everything too. And when he sees the works that Christopher is reading, Christopher is 10 years older or something of that nature. So by this time, he's an older teen, young adult, and he starts seeing, you know, names out there like Isaac Asimov and, I mean, words he can't even pronounce, you know, names that are, I'm spacing out the German philosopher I have in there. Jonathan is struck by that.
Mm.
And then Christopher also... is counter to a foil or balance to Jonathan in this way, physically. Because Jonathan, as a boy, is not physically attractive in the popular sense. Christopher is. And I compare him to James Dean.
Right,
you know, in, you know, Rebel Without a Cause, slick back hair, you know. Yet there's a meanness. There's a in Christopher. So when you read this, I mean, they... you know, as when they're growing up, there's this, you know, and that's confusing to Jonathan. How could someone, something so beautiful, also be so ugly?
Right.
And so that's intriguing for him as a boy, and then he has to process that in life, too. So I bring that up, you know, within the Christopher compared to Theodore. Jonathan is observing both now, right. And then in that one conversation about halfway through the novel, and he and Christopher have a really enlightened exchange over stuff, and they start talking about Albert Camus, you know, and the
who of course comes back in it becomes
and everything
crucial.
Too. So I really try to make these characters develop as very round, complete, you know, and I shouldn't even say complete because there's aspects of them that I probably don't even realize that are there until we start talking about it.
Well, I mean, that's the greatness of developing characters is to develop a character that's well-rounded enough to feel real.
Mm-hmm.
Talked a lot about some of the male characters in the book. Tell me a little bit about the role that Jonathan's mother plays in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, what influence does she have on him? And of course, with her death... in Jonathan's early adult years, how does her absence or death impact him as well?
She's the feminine, of course,
right.
The matriarch, as you say, and represents that everything to him. She is his world as when he starts coming a little bit of age and conscious. And I go back to... Joseph Campbell in this regard too, that when a baby is born, it's part of the mother. And then to get sustenance for life, what does the baby do? It sucks on the mother's nipple, okay, and gets the milk, the sustenance there. So there is this bonding between infant and child, or mother, you know, from the get-go. Well, then, as he grows, he's in a one-parent family. And, you know, he's got older brothers, he's got older sisters. But mother is the one in charge here. And so she's very dutiful. I mean, and one of my good friends who read the novel for me and wrote a beautiful endorsement of it, our old friend up here, Joan Fitzgerald, she's a, you know, former the president of the Colorado Senate, read it. And when she and I talked about it, what struck her was the role of mother. Because, you know, Joan now being my age, older, right. Being a mother, grandmother and everything. And her point about how when families go into crisis, confront great tragedy, almost always it's the mother who pulls it everyone together and right. sets aside her own personal grief, pain, agony. She, you know, she's the mother hen, or, you know, I mean, just protects her, you know, her brood and everything like that. And so Jonathan, of course, you know, finds, you know, loves her dearly and is attached to her in his upbringing. Now, I also bring that into the church, because it's one thing Catholics do say about their church that others, Protestants, you know, Presbyterians and Lutherans, etc., do not, and they call the church mother. It's Holy Mother Church.
Right.
So church is also nurturing and mother, and he goes to church with mother.
And yet is that contrasted by the fact that in some essence, in the case of Jonathan's literal mother, that she is the, because of the absence of father, she is to some degree or another the value setter. And in setting values, there is some sense of judgment or taking away from unconditional love. The idea that these are the values that we want you to have, or we will judge you otherwise. And the same thing about the church. And I think that that's part of the conflict that Jonathan finds within the church and within his own religion, mm-hmm. is he wants, to some degree or another, he wants religion, and this will segue perfectly, but he wants to find in religion a love and acceptance mm-hmm. that a Catholic faith is simply unable to provide. The Catholic faith is too paternal, too patriarchal in its nature, to really provide that unconditional love. The Catholic Church is nothing if not judgmental.
Right. And there are several scenes.
And that's what he butts up against.
Exactly. You're exactly right, Stephen. There are several scenes in the story, starting from when he's a little boy and his mother's there for him. And she, you know, about his learning, when he gets his Catholic Missal, you know, and she says, "Sister, he can handle this," you know, and he's proud of that. And then when the older brother, you know, gets frustrated with him because he broke his glasses and everything. I mean, that is heart-wrenching for me, you know, to read that there. But mother is right there anyway. And then at the end, or not, it's not at the end, but as he matures into adulthood, finally gets to that level, and then has to come and talk to his mother. He doesn't have to. He chooses to. And without giving the spoiler alert, her response is, it says it all.
It says everything. And it's as he turns into adulthood that he begins to see that conflict between the church and as he idealized it as a child,
yes,
versus the reality of the conflict that it creates within him between his own lifestyle choice mm-hmm. and the value judgment that comes from that church.
Right.
That he inevitably, that is inevitably the aspect that he struggles with. And just to give a quick quote, and I'd love to hear how, because I find this quote really powerful. On page 105, Jonathan says, he's talking to Father Reginald and says, "Okay, maybe I'm becoming even more sarcastic and cynical, but I'm beginning to wonder why any God gets his kicks watching people suffer." Now, the way that's expressed, there is a definitive cynicism, and there's a pain that goes along with that. What mm-hmm. the idea that God gets his kicks, mm-hmm. it makes it trivial. Mm-hmm. It seems to imply a frivolity, that God gets his mild amusement from watching us suffer. Do you think that's true, and do you think Jonathan thinks that's true?
No, I don't believe in a God like that. But I think that's the what.
But does Jonathan at that moment in the novel?
Yes, I think he does. Yeah, at that point, because he's a young man. You know, he's an older teenager. And he's now figuring it out. He's going to college and or late high school. I can't remember exactly. I think he's in college at that point. Yes, he is. Okay. And so, as all young people do, you go to college, you start taking classes in philosophy, et cetera. And because of the brain growth, and you start to put stuff in, you're learning and hearing from your professors and teachers in context of your life. And so that's his juvenile adult way of looking at it. Eventually, what he does is he rejects that notion of a God like that. And when we were talking a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about your story and how it ties in with the book of Job in the Old Testament. And, Job or God has a bet with Satan or something like that. Well, that's, that's a heck of a thing to be toying with your human beings just to satisfy a wager you have with, your kind of arch enemy that you created. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. But there is this dilemma that comes up within this Christian idea of God as judger and everything. And why do we see it? Well, we are, born to suffer and to die, for what purpose? It doesn't make sense.
It's perfect bringing up the book of Job in that particular instance because, of course, poor Job suffers horribly. He suffers at the hand of God for really no other reason, no other rationalization that he can understand other than the idea of God's own self-aggrandizement, because I told you so. And that, I think, is really difficult. Here, what Jonathan struggles with, though, is, for the church is somehow or another created with the idea of reinforcing the traditional values of that society. Mm-hmm. It both puts forth those values, instills those values, and then reinforces those values afterwards.
Right.
But if you have a young person like Jonathan whose lifestyle does not go with that, he himself is honest with himself enough to know who he is, and that butts up against the very things he's been taught since day one.
Right.
That struggle has to be monumental for him.
It is.
And that has to be. So on page 54, I thought this was another interesting passage. This is at his mother's funeral, and he says, closing his eyes and clenching his teeth, Jonathan surveyed the countless times he had bared himself in that confessional booth. It's a great word there, bared himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a number of levels on which that works. By divulging his inner life, his private world, to another man not of his choosing. Mm-hmm. It is about power, he said to himself. I gave them my power for no purpose. Mm-hmm. Mild anger rose within him for allowing himself to be subjugated and debased. Another two great words right there. His dignity shredded, but when he realized what was happening, he recognized it, honored it, and let it subside. Mm-hmm. He thought of the running water that lulled him to sleep countless times as a boy. Mm-hmm. How is Catholicism about giving up power?
It is submission to a dogma, to a code, and there's no deviation from it. Unlike in the Protestant tradition, in which a Christian finds resolution, forgiveness, whatever, for sins directly to God, in the Catholic world, there's this intermediary called the priest. And you have to tell the priest, literally, you have to tell him exactly what you did and how many times you did it. And I think when he is now, because he's now an older, he's an older adult, and he's reflecting back on that, and he realizes this, and he's angry over the fact that he had to go through this. He's done it countless times, as all Catholics do. You go in there.
For decades he's done this.
Yeah. And it is a part of a, to me, humiliation and a shameful process. And that's how we get people ultimately under control, is to shame them. And that's what he feels in that regard when he goes in you know, into that confessional booth how many times, like countless other Catholics. It's a shaming, demeaning thing. You are putting yourself at the, you're debasing yourself in front of this other human being who is ostensibly Jesus at that moment.
But an intermediary form. He's a spokesperson. Yeah. He's Jesus's and God's spokesperson in the form of the flesh. Why do you think Catholicism needs that intermediary that perhaps Protestant faiths don't necessarily need?
Catholicism rose, you know, from 2,000 years ago. And, you know, at that time, that was, the Roman Empire. And so, you know, we had the Holy Roman Empire, and it became the Catholic Church and the Pope and the Emperor and all that was all intertwined. Keep in mind, Protestantism, when it arose, was in the nascent stage of the in the Renaissance. And when we start developing this concept of individual liberty and so forth. And so what we find in a huge contrast between Catholicism and Protestantism in the Christian world is the difference in large part between communitarianism and individualism. That within the Catholic Church, it is community. It is the church. There's a little side note. My editor and I had great discussion on this because she says, do you use uppercase C for church? No, of course, you know, it's just a building. But when you're saying the church, everyone knows what we're talking about. We're talking about the Roman Catholic Church. We're not talking about the Orthodox. We're not talking about the Presbyterian. We're talking about the Catholic Church. So it is uppercase. It's become, you know, that powerful of a concept there. Protestantism is more based on, the individual. And yes, you accept Jesus as your personal savior. You know, you interact there, and the minister, the pastor, the reverend is up there to help facilitate that relationship. But you don't need to go and bow down to that person in a submissive, authoritarian role.
I found it interesting what you just said, that that when we use capital C church, that we quote unquote all know what that means, even people who are not Catholic. That's a pretty telling statement, that somebody at some point or another, that when we capitalize something, it's of more importance. Mm-hmm. That the Catholic Church is somehow or another, it's almost as if it's shamed even the followers of Protestantism. It is even shamed them into a blind obedience that they're not even aware of. That to somehow or another, they have put themselves in a position of power by shaming even those who don't subscribe to the faith.
Yeah, and I wouldn't go so far perhaps to say shaming of it, but nonetheless, after 500 years, 600 years, whatever it is, after the Protestant Reformation, Protestant churches, for example, don't declare saints. The Catholic Church does that.
Right.
They just declared, I think, John Paul II a saint, or real close to it, or something like that. Mm. Yet we see Protestant churches out there named for saints, whoever they may be.
Right.
Where does this sainthood thing come in?
As if they're the little sibling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. A good way.
It's almost like Theodore. It's almost that relationship between Theodore and Jonathan.
Yeah,
little brother.
When Pope Francis came to the country here some months ago, it was a big to do, man. All the networks broadcasting everything there. If the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church or the Greek Orthodox Church came, it wouldn't be that, splash and everything. Donald Trump got into it with the Pope when the Pope stood on the other side of the border and said some things, indirectly about him, and Trump took him on. He's a power. It's a power there. The Vatican itself is an independent country within the state of Italy.
Right.
It has we have a papal nuncio over there. It's like an ambassador. The Catholic Church is very different than any other religious institution in the world, period.
And so do you think that the Catholic Church, to some degree or another, is about that a power grab by the people, by the individuals who make up the church, capital C? Is this a relationship of power between – because when we – for those of us who have a healthy and constructive relationship with our own religious faith, whatever that might be, it's a relationship of love and – deliverance.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that you read in your novel about Sisyphus Wins seems to be that it's more, this is not a relationship of nurturing a relationship between God. It's I'm going to stand here as intermediary. Mm-hmm. And that gives me all the power in the world. Mm-hmm. That this is more a relationship, not about delivering one to their highest state of spiritual being, but rather a sense of subjugation. And I think that's right. What Jonathan feels right. So distinctly. Do you think that that's then why Theodore becomes a priest? Is it that is Theodore on a quest for power grab?
I think that's part of it right there. Yeah. And I think that leaves it open to the reader and say, that's a great question. So why does Theodore take the path he does, okay, compared to the one Jonathan does too, okay? Is it strictly about power? There's some other issues that in mind too, you know, in his unconscious that he kind of puts away. And therefore, you know, he's able to move on, you know, and just kind of function through his life rather than what I would call living a life.
So what would you describe as the irony there between Theodore's mission in becoming a priest and what his actual motivation is? Is there an inherent irony between you go into the faith with the idea of I'm going to help others? Where's the irony and what really draws him then?
Well, I think there's a contrast. There's a not only Theodore, but let's compare him to Father Reginald.
Perfect contrast.
Right. And because from my point of view, and you know, that Father Reginald now personifies that Christian ideal, that it is about love. It is about compassion. It's about forgiveness. You have to forgive yourself before you can forgive others. You know,
absolutely. I mean,
this is going to hear. You know,
it's the New Testament vision of Christ. It's almost a Theodore Old Testament vision of God, and yeah. Father Reginald is that new covenant that God forms with man. You know, and that somehow or another, right. I'm here to deliver you, not to. Which one do you think, if that's true, which one do you think is more representative of the Catholic faith as it was constituted in the time of Jonathan's youth, and perhaps as it's constituted now?
I have this philosophy that back in the 60s, Vatican II, and I bring that into the novel mm-hmm. somewhat and talk about that there are two powerful strains within Catholicism. One is dogma. These are the rules. This is what you believe in. Here it is. The other is the mystery. You know, the... And Jonathan expresses that, I think, beautifully at the beginning of the story. You know, patted myself on the back writing it too, by the way.
I'll let you say that, not
yeah,
me.
Yeah. But I think he does, you know, and because about the incense, the candles. You walk into a Catholic church, it's very different than walking into a Presbyterian church and so forth. You know, there's all the ritual, there's that mystery that's there, and it just seems to carry in there, and you can't put your finger on it. And you say, okay, this has to connect to the transcendent. So my philosophy there. So if there's this dichotomy of Catholicism there, Vatican II chose to exercise to get rid of, and what they chose to get rid of more was the mystery, turning the priest towards the people, for example. Okay, it was a little thing about democracy, I guess, you know, and somehow we're going to make it all one and everything. It never really worked, but from my point of view. But they eliminated a lot of the common or the depth, the mysteriousness of the faith there, but kept rigidly the dogma, you know, women as priests. Oh, my God. I mean, we might elect, my point of view, hopefully,
the first female
president. But, oh, no, we can't have one as a priest. Yet every other tradition, Protestant tradition, as far as I know, have female ministers. Why not? Okay, makes total sense to me.
It was interesting. I remember I taught at a Catholic school, Mullen High School, down in Denver years ago, and was talking to one of the brothers. It was a Christian brothers school, and I loved talking to them. Very interesting and intellectual gentlemen. And I remember asking one, which do you think will happen first within the Catholic faith, that priests will be allowed to marry, or whether there'll be female priests? in my own opinion, thinking that the latter would come first, but as a novice, as an outsider, and you're shaking your head no right now, and that was exactly the answer I got. He's like, oh, they'll never, women will never be priests.
No.
And that's that mystery. That mystery that you talked to about the, you know, the incense and the whole experience, having been brought up myself in the Episcopalian faith, which I like to say is like Catholic light, just one calorie of guilt. And and but I, like our connection with the minister was far more transparent. There wasn't this, you know, this sort of cloud of secrecy. It's almost like that curtain in The Wizard of Oz, right? That the great Wizard of Oz stands behind. As long as he's mysterious and you don't see him, but when you pull back the curtain, you see the whole engineerings of how everything's working behind it. And part of why the Catholic faith sets up that entire mystery, that entire shroud, is to keep those inner working secret. And as long as you do that, you feel powerless. You feel indebted. You feel you feel to somehow or another that you subscribe to the whole mystery of it all because you don't know. Mm-hmm. And it's a relationship as it is between you and God that is not definitive as it is. And so as such, there's some degree of that. Wanted to move on to another motivation within Catholic faith. I thought this was an amazing one too. On page 190, I left the Catholic Church, which to me has become a superstitious, power-hungry organization that achieves its goals by promising the worst form of outcome, eternal damnation, if you don't live in accordance with its strictures. Mm-hmm. You talked about the force that shame has in the power of the church. There's another motivation right there. What do you think that? What's going on there?
Ultimate terror. Ultimate terror. They're going to spend eternity in, you know, the worst circumstances it possibly can be. And, you know, we think of human torture here. And, oh, my God, I mean, the 20th century is replete with that. 21st century now, you know, what we do to human beings here. But there's a finality to that. Because once they're dead, you know, that's no consolation. But once you're dead, you escape. From that, there's no escape from hell.
Right.
None. And that's the ultimate power there. And so, and I bring that up because in the church, that if you die with mortal sin on your soul, not forgiven, then you go to hell for eternity. So you miss Mass for one Sunday. Sucks to be you. You were Mother Teresa up to that point. But you blew it off and decided to stay home and watch the football game. Okay, because the Broncos are on an early game, you know, playoff there. So, okay. And then you get out and you get T-boned before you get to the confessional booth. I mean, this sort of stuff is just like, to me, insane here. And
it's like your mom always reminding you to make sure that you wear clean underwear every time you go out because you'd hate to be caught dead.
And you have to be perfect every time.
Absolutely.
And I bring in, you know, several times in the story, like his mother says, well, have you gone to confession? You know, that sort of stuff there. You know, to the absolution and everything there too. When he's with Father Reginald, and he says, you know, and when you go into a confessional and the old, I don't do it anymore, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. So he says to Father Reginald, who's right in front of him, so you brought up curtain. Because when you go into a confessional booth, there is a curtain. There's
literally
a screen there. Right. You're blocked off, you know. And so I give that imagery. But when he's talking to Father Reginald, he's right there. And he tells him, he flat out, this is what I did, you know, with no judgment, no shame. You know, it's like, and he has that discussion about, you know, what I feel guilty about. He's, mm-hmm. I don't feel guilty about this. Mm-hmm. Oh, I feel guilty about eating meat on Friday, which is, you know, like.
But I don't feel guilty about myself.
About myself and who I am and everything
right,
like
because
that.
Because eating meat is a choice I make.
Right.
You know, his sexuality is not a choice.
Right.
And that's the mistake I think that we make, the trap that we fall into is to somehow think why that's not a moral issue is that it's not a choice that we make. Whether I choose to eat meat or not on Friday is a choice. What my sexuality is not a choice. And that, I think, is the trap that we fall into. Yeah. What I love about that passage is that I think that it gets to what truly one of the great motivators of human beings is, and that's fear. Even as much, and it goes right along with shame, because shame is the fear of being of being judged by the society around you. They're both, the fear and shame are walk hand in hand down the aisle together, and it brought me up to the famous Voltaire quote of, "If God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him." Mm-hmm. Why? Why? And if you're, how do you think the Catholic faith answers that question? Why is God necessary?
I don't know if it really does. They go back a priori and say he simply is. But, you know, so I think they would default in the conversation. Remember, Voltaire was in the Age of Enlightenment, too. And so he started to look at things rationally,
right?
You know, and saying, so where does this notion of God come from? You know, I'll go back, and it's probably not really addressing the question at hand here. But I get back to the Roman Empire, and it was a very polytheistic empire. You know, they conquered Greece. They liked their gods, so they just brought them over and renamed them. You know, they conquer Egypt, and they kind of like Isis, and they went, hey, not bad. We'll have a temple of Isis in Rome, too. You know, they were very inviting and egalitarian. I mean, they just brought everybody in. They didn't cast judgment on. You know, as long as you pay your taxes, we don't care how you worship. That's not true in Christianity or Islam, which are, you know, the go and spread the gospel to all, you know, and if you're not with Allah, you're against Allah. You know, there's just the other. And it really began with Judaism back 500-600 years before the birth of Christ, so before the Common Era, I like to say, when Israel was taken captive by the Babylonians, you know, a minor tribe in there. And so they're trying to build up their ego. It's kind of like Napoleonic complex here. So developed this concept of the monotheistic God, one God. Yahweh was just part of the larger spectrum there. He's just one of the many gods of the Middle East. El was the big one, and Yahweh was one. But somehow Yahweh got surfaced up there as the God of Israel. There is one God. And so it was Israel against the rest of the world. And we have a power above that we could ask intercession for to give us power. I was reading Joseph Campbell at 2 o'clock this morning.
And a scary image.
Couple three passages from Deuteronomy about that, you know, power and everything. So I think it's because I don't know if the church could answer that in that way, because they just can't have that conversation.
But don't you think what Voltaire is getting at in that particular passage is that he's suggesting that to some degree or another, that society needs us to believe in God in order to get human beings to adhere to a social a value structure. And that's exactly what you were getting to with the idea of eternal damnation. Mm-hmm. That eternal damnation is the fear, the boogeyman that we put into every kid. Do this or else. Make sure you behave or else. And I used to, when I was talking about it, I used to call it divine systems of justice with my students. Because in this lifetime, if I go out and I rob the Safeway store, I'm not going to, by the way, but if I were to go out and I were to rob the Safeway store and I could get away with it. There's a great movie, Crimes and Misdemeanors by Woody Allen, great film in which he hires someone to kill his wife and he gets away with it. But his Catholic guilt starts to come back and eat away at him. Because to some degree or another, in this lifetime, human systems of justice are fallible. You might get away with something that you do in this lifetime, but the greatness, the idea of having a divine system of justice, of getting us to believe into a moral system that's created by and supported by the divine, is that even after your death, even if humans don't catch you, God will.
Yeah,
it's like Santa Claus, right? It's this whole idea of Santa Claus. You know, think of Santa Claus as coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake.
Exactly.
Right.
But on the other hand, that's subscribing to the idea that in order to have an ethical moral code, we are dependent upon an omniscient, greater, transcendent power. That's subscribing to that and just saying, I agree with that. I don't agree with that. That societies could have within themselves, and certainly, you know, before there were monotheistic gods, a god somewhere. We had very ethical, noble people living in Greece, Rome, India, and everywhere else. Absolutely. Who did right, because it's the nature of people, because to survive, if we have to take care of each other, in order to do that. And so, you know, that's one of the aspects of life is that, first of all, there is the desire for life in the first place. Mm-hmm. Okay. But then, and there's the desire to recreate life. Okay. And then there is that pillaging and that other, the taking of others too. Well, it's one thing to take it away from that country over there. You start taking it within context of our own society. It's called robbery.
Right.
Then we're going to come apart. And so we learn early, we don't need a transcendent God to answer that. So to Voltaire's question, I would say, yeah, for some people, that's probably true. But right. I think that's presupposes something that's not necessarily. And by the way, we got about 4 minutes left. So,
oh my word! All right, well, we better move along. Thank you. I was not looking. Very good. All right. wanted to ask you about a few of the in the novel. There are a number of allusions to previous literary works, and some of them just brilliant. Talk a little bit about the reference to Jonathan Edwards' Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. You and I have both taught that, I am sure, at one point or another. And you want to talk about that idea of fire and brimstone and the spider hanging from a thread. Ew. Why is that such an important work? Important illusion within Sisyphus Winds?
Oh, because it ties right in. Even he was a fundamentalist minister,
right,
preaching hot fire, hell, and brimstone back in the 18th century,
right,
you know, in the Great Awakening, and all, you know, like this, and that ties right in with that whole idea of a powerful, mean, energetic God who will judge you and, you know, and cast you into that fire without giving you a second thought.
And isn't that what Jonathan feels, that fear of a faith that is trying to use, of the Catholic faith trying to use fear of eternal damnation, mm-hmm, in order to change his value system and his own sexual orientation.
You have to keep the troops in line,
right?
That's what
and they dangle you right above it. And I thought that that was a perfect metaphor within the novel, that to some degree or another, that Jonathan feels this clash between his own value system and life, the life that he's living, and he doesn't feel guilty about.
Right, but at that point, when he's talking about it, he has now rejected that, though.
Right.
Yeah, because that's why it's so much fun to teach. He's not in terror of it. He's, man, this is magnificent, because look at the power of this story here. As ridiculous as it is, you know. I mean, oh, yeah, it's great stuff.
So let's move on. Moby Dick.
Mm-hmm.
Why is Moby Dick so important to the novel?
For a number of reasons. You know, that... It's his first true intellectual work that he gets into, and then he falls in love with the work. He sees in the story the white whale, Moby Dick, who's gone to the depths of the ocean, who knows everything, Ahab, who's angry, bitter, in mortal combat with it. It's on a cosmic plane that this struggle is going on, when Ahab at the end, when he's hurling the spear at Moby Dick, and I cast my last hate at you, I spit my last breath at you, and he's hurling upon the hump of the whale all the rage that man has felt through eternity, you know, that's coming up from this here. But I also tie the characters.
That's what I was going to ask you. What represents the whale and within Sisyphus Winds? What represents the whale? What represents Ahab?
Yes. I conflate them, actually. If you look at the description of Theodore initially, mm-hmm, you can see both. And then, you know, without giving too much away, you know, spoiler alert sort of thing here, and Jonathan, when he starts to realize himself, oh my God, there go I. You know, I mean, that is like, whoa, I am now there too, you know, got into this struggle here. So yeah, Moby Dick is really, yeah, I mean, it's key to it, and that's why I use extended passages in there too. And I know they're challenging for the reader, but
it's brilliant though. Speaking of difficult texts, but ones you use brilliantly within the novel, Myth of Sisyphus by Albert Camus. Mm-hmm. Incredibly important. Tell folks very briefly the story of Sisyphus and what mm-hmm, Camus' article, the Myth of Sisyphus, is about, and then talk about how that relates here. I know we just have a couple minutes.
So we'll go over a minute or two here. But yeah, that's huge. Sisyphus from the Greek mythology is condemned by the gods to push a rock up the hill for eternity because he refused to worship them. He laughed at them. He thought they were a joke. He loved life, and he refused, you know, to capture death, put her into chains. And Hades wasn't happy about that. So they snatched up Sisyphus and judged him, and there you go. And so the metaphor for that is also, if you look at the story, because the initial setting of the story is on Mount of the Holy Cross here in Colorado. Mm-hmm. Well, right on the cover of the book, you have a picture of Mount of the Holy Cross. Well, who carried a cross? Jesus, right? Where did he carry it? Up a hill, Calvary. Okay. So he's carrying a burden, as is Sisyphus, pushing a burden. It's not the same story, but they're similar in that context there. So, huge in there. And then the way Camus is able to take that, he says, I'm not interested so much in what's going through his mind as he's pushing up the rock and hill, which is a metaphor for our drudgery of life, like doing something over and over and over.
The meaningless of life itself. Yeah.
Yeah, the futility of life, exactly. What is the meaning? He says, but the one time Sisyphus is free when he's walking back down the hill. What's going through his mind? That's when we're free. He's no longer under control of the gods. He can think and do whatever he wants. Okay, how does that play out for us in this too there? And there's far more in there too, so I just encourage people, pick it up. His essays, I mean, he's just brilliant the way he gets
Sisyphus wins, but at the end of this novel, the reader wins. It really is. It's a novel that challenges us to evaluate where we stand within the context of our own society, but also leaves us invigorated for the state of the individual spirit. I can assure you that as a reader, as I got to the end, I felt better about my own place within a society that at times can be stifling. Individual and Sisyphus, and in this case, Jonathan and my good friend Jerry, all walk away winners. And I can't encourage you folks enough to go out, purchase a copy, read it. You will be better off for having read the novel.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here. This was terrific.
Yeah. I mean, great questions. Great conversation. You get ready to get me thinking. I go, oh, I hadn't even thought of that. I just love it. So, all right, everybody. Hey, this is Jerry Fabian, KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And this has been Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole. And I brought you this last hour. So go to my website. Learn about more here on Sisyphus Wins, jerryfabianic.com. And we have recorded this show, and I'll get it uploaded both to the radios and to my website here probably about the first of next week here. So I will be back in a couple of weeks, and in the meantime, we'll just give you some more music and just be safe and have a great day. All right, bye now.